You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 29th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mercedes Schneider, public school teacher, education activist, on the upcoming House Senate Conference Committee to reauthorize No Child Left Behind. Also on the program today, Planned Parenthood under assault in the Senate, and conservatives fire another shot across the bow of John Boehner. I feel like we haven't even said his name in years. Also on the program today, Peanut Executive. Those salmonella sales didn't work out so well for folks. Caveat emptor, would, as the libertarians say. Who could imagine that a peanut salesman, manufacturer, would sell salmonella. It's not good for business, so why would you ever do that?
Definitely getting my peanuts from another company.
Yes.
If I haven't died.
Right.
Meanwhile,
on the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton hedges big time on Keystone XL. Something she does just mystifies me. That's one of them. And live by the polls, Bernie Sanders fares quite well against the potential Republican nominee, assuming there is going to be one. I still contend it's possible no one wins the race for the Republican Party. And speaking of which, Donald Trump again proves why he's a genius if he's put in a room full of Republicans. Chris Christie on pot. Fortunately, he will never become president. And Boston bans the Olympics. Not exactly, but pretty close. Pretty close. All this on the program today, ladies and gentlemen. A little house cleaning. Tomorrow will be a Matt and Mike Thursday. And I will be back, assuming all goes well, on Friday. And we are already gearing up for what we're calling around here the greatest day of our lives. That is next Thursday, where the Republican debate will happen. Now, here's the thing. As you know, there are, what is it now? What are we up to? 47 candidates? 16 candidates running for president in the Republican primary. Now, Mitt Romney hasn't jumped back in yet, so let's call it 16.2. And on August 6th, a Thursday, the plan was first for just a normal debate at 9 p.m., 90 minutes long, But what are we going to do? We have too many people. We can't fit them all on stage. So it will be the aggregate, or I guess the average, of the latest national polling. I'm not sure how far back they go. I think it's maybe over the last 3 months. And there's some discrepancy depending on who you get the information from as to who's going to be eligible for the debates. We'll get to that in a moment. But there will be a kids' table. So the adults, well, let's be honest. There's basically an elementary school table and a tweeners table. The tweeners go at 9 p.m. Those are the first 10 eligible candidates. Then at 5 p.m., there's a forum. That used to be scheduled for 1 p.m., but they bumped it up because the elementary school kids were whining so much that it was the only way to keep them quiet. And as long as you get them to bed by 7, they'll be fine. So 5 p.m. debate or forum, 1 hour. They all take a bath. You read them a book. They'll be in bed by 7. Now, here's the thing. The elementary schoolers, they were complaining because the cutoff for that was that you needed to have 1% in the polls. And it turns out like half of them didn't even have that. So they have now blown that away, meaning that Carly Fiorina, George Pataki, and yes, Lindsey Graham, that phone destruction artist, will now be included in the kids' table debate or forum. And I promise you, their teeth will be brushed. They will be bathed before they get to sleep by 7. Now, according to Politico, and there's one sort of interesting point, aside from the fact that that day is going to be a lot of fun. I would imagine the 5 p.m. Undercard, as it were, is going to be pretty boring. Although, it sort of depends who the sixth person is included in that. According to Politico, the top 10 right now are Donald Trump, of course, number 1, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Mike Huckabee, Ben Carson, Governor Chris Christie, and Rick Perry. According to Huffington Post, that number 10 spot is filled by John Kasich. And Rick Perry is sitting at the kids' table as opposed to Kasich. According to Politico, the undercard includes Kasich, Rick Santorum, Bobby Jindal, Fiorina, Pataki, and Graham. So that's going to be fascinating to see where Kasich is, because I still contend, I think it's unlikely, because even if you get into that debate, 90 minutes divided by 10, assuming the moderators say some things, you know, you're only talking about 8 minutes of talking time, and you know Trump is going to take about 15 or 20. Kasich, is the most threatening of Republicans. And I think Kasich is probably would be the one who really could go toe-to-toe with Trump on some level. And, of course, the guy's down around 4%, so he doesn't have a lot to lose. Here's another fascinating statistic from Politico. I'm going to give you the hour-by-hour breakdown of how much time the Republican candidates have had on Fox News. This is from Politico, the hour-by-hour breakdown. Very interesting. This is a tally of the total combined Fox News Channel and Fox Business Network appearances. Or this isn't by hours. This is by the number, okay, I should say. Some of these, though, I mean, Trump, I think, probably on Fox Business News for an hour. But, you know, there's literally about 6,000 or 7,000 people, I think, who watch Fox Business News. They just all drive nice cars. So there's some ad revenue there. All right, number one, Rand Paul, 35. 35 appearances since the his campaign launched. Huckabee, 31. Trump, 30. Perry, 24. Fiorina and Jindal at 20 each. Cruz, 17. Santorum, 16. Rubio, 14. And this sort of surprised me. Carson only has been on 12 times. Ben Carson. And Lindsey Graham has been on 12 times. And presumably that's just because he asked Donald Trump to help him get on the network. Kasich and Pataki, 11 each.
I'm amazed that Pataki got up into double digits.
You know what?
That's impressive.
When Pataki, I was on with him on Dylan Radigan's show back in whatever it was, 2011? I don't remember. The word in the building was, I heard somebody say this to me, and I can't remember who it was for the life of me. It wasn't Dylan Radigan. Pataki's been seen on 6th Avenue just walking back and forth between Fox News and MSNBC just trying to get on television. He's so bored. And nobody will talk to him. Like, literally, I imagine, like, the hot dog salesman there is just, like, tired of, like, Pataki coming up and talking to him.
I get it. I shouldn't have Social Security. I shouldn't have any retirement. Thank you. Would you like a hot dog, Mr. Governor? Please. If not, could you please let
Move
me do
on.
My work? Thank you.
Chris Christie, 7 appearances. Walker, 4 appearances. Bush, 3. So you can see who's trying to appeal to the middle more, right? Kasich, Pataki, Christie, Walker, Bush. So there it is, in preparation for what we call around here the greatest day of our lives.
It's going to be really fun.
It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. But also, it's because Noah's folks are coming in. And that's going to be fun, too.
Did you get my specifications, Noah?
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Mercedes Schneider about the upcoming House Senate Conference Committee to hammer out what No Child Left Behind is going to look like. And, of course, it's going to have big implications as to education policy, broadly speaking, but also what's going to happen with testing and high-stakes testing back in your kid's school or your community school. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome
Mercedes.
I'm sorry. I had it right. Mercedes Schneider. She blogs at the Huffington Post. She's a public high school teacher and education activist, author of The Common Core Dilemma, Who Owns Our Schools, and also blogs at her own blog at deutsch29.wordpress.com. We'll have links at majority.fm. So tell us, I mean, just back up for us as to what is involved in the reauthorization. What has been the history of reauthorizing No Child Left Behind, and why is this so important for what ultimately becomes sort of the primary driver of education policy in this country?
Well, are you asking me why is it important that it's not originally No Child Left Behind? It's the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. No Child Left Behind is just a catchy name that Bush gave it. But are you asking me why are we reauthorizing that?
Well, I mean, let's talk about the, you know, why are we reauthorizing it now? What has been the history of the sort of the reauthorization of that? And what is being added to it that's going to be relevant?
Okay, well, hopefully it's what's going to be removed from it that's going to be relevant, but I know that that's just a matter of semantics. In 2001, under President George W. Bush, No Child Left Behind was the reauthorization, the next reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. The big push through No Child Left Behind was Bush and Congress said, okay, we are going to force schools that take Title I money to do better by putting these testing mandates on the schools, on the teachers in the school, that we're going to raise achievement. We're going to raise achievement for different subcategories of students, and the schools are going to set their goals and they're going to meet those goals, or they're going to face sanctions, which could include firing teachers and staff or takeover of a school, conversion to charter school. So it's very punitive. But it began with an unrealistic goal that by 2014, 100% of students in the public schools would be proficient in reading and math. Now, that was a setup that, you know, we want perfection by 2014. By the time 2007 rolled around and No Child Left Behind was supposed to be reauthorized, Congress didn't want to touch it because it was already deemed as a failure. This is not going to happen. We're not going to have this perfection by 2014. And so the thought in 2007, generally speaking, was, hey, we've got an election coming up in 2008. This is a political bomb, and we just don't want to tamper with it. So No Child Left Behind has been on life support, so to speak, because the Congress has not had that same kumbaya moment that they had in 2001, where they, everybody, Democrats, Republicans, said, yeah, this is a great idea. And so here we are in 2015, and Congress finally has said, look, we have to do something about this. No Child Left Behind is expired. 2014 has passed, and so now states are on these No Child Left Behind waivers that Arne Duncan, as U.S. Secretary of Education, is controlling and saying, hey, you want to get out of the sanctions for a No Child Left Behind that doesn't work anyway, then here's what I want you to do. I want you to prove that you have college and career-ready standards, which is a euphemism for Common Core. I want you to guarantee me that you're going to continue to test your teachers using student test scores. And so he's got these waivers, and that has gone over rather badly in the press with the public, and Congress is aware of. So here we are in July, end of July 2015, and the House has a version reauthorization.
Mercedes, let me just stop you and just go back a little bit to tease some stuff out. So now this may seem like an obvious question, but why was it unrealistic at the time to I guess, attempt to get to full proficiency by 2014?
It's because it wasn't aspirational. It wasn't, they weren't saying, let's see how close we can get. Let's see how, it wasn't that positive. It was punitive. It was like, states, you will meet this or you will face sanctions. Now, you tell me, any state, any country, you go ahead, throw Massachusetts, great education reputation in the public schools in Massachusetts or Connecticut. You throw them in that mix and you tell me one state that has 100% proficiency. It's unrealistic, but it was, states were to be sanctioned. They were to be punished for not reaching that.
So in other words, it's one thing to say, okay, I want you to have a goal of achieving X percentage improvement, or but to have that cutoff line, everybody knew it was sort of, it was flawed. I mean, what was the theory behind that, though? I mean, was it just, is it really? I mean, why would you set what, which is, you know, I mean, quite clear. I think common sense tells you, like, there's no way every school in every state is going to reach this standards. And then so you're automatically, you might as well just pass a law saying by 2014 or by whatever these benchmarks, we're going to punish these schools. If it was clearly against common sense to put those type of benchmarks, what was the agenda there?
Well, there are a couple of issues. First off, we had George Bush coming in and saying, hey, when I was governor of Texas, we did these kind of reforms and they worked. Test scores shot up. He even said that before. Who was he saying it to? One of the groups, even as they were having a collaboration over whether or not to approve No Child Left Behind, he was saying this in a speech to a national group, National Urban League. And he was saying, we did this great thing in Texas. Well, first off, the great thing you did in Texas was not 100% proficiency. Some test scores went up. Secondly, there were a couple of studies coming out and saying, we've got problems with these great test score gains because we've got issues, for example, with kids dropping out.
Right.
You have a dropout problem. Now, in the discussions that of the congressional committee, the conference committee that led to No Child Left Behind, this went on in August of 2001, Hillary Clinton, who was a senator of New York at that time, even spoke about the issues with dropouts in Texas. Texas has a dropout problem. But they looked past that for some reason. They just bought it. Okay, forget. Okay, Bush says the test scores are going up. Forget that Texas has a dropout problem. We're just going to go with this.
All right, I should explain to people that, obviously, I mean, just so that we're clear, that if your worst students presumably would be the ones who drop out, I mean, I guess you occasionally you'll have a great student drop out of high school, but it tends to be the struggling students, the ones who are in some way underachieving, they will drop out, and so you're left with a pool of people who, statistically speaking, of course, are going to do better because the people who have the most problems have already dropped out of school.
That's right, and so they don't get. But Sam, there's another piece there too, and it was the belief that behind this, American teachers are lazy. If we will only threaten them, if we will threaten their jobs, then they will do better by the students. They, you know, that's the idea. American schools are lazy. And then there's this idea that American education, going back to 1983, A Nation at Risk, the American education system has put America in a compromised position as a world economy and as a world power. And it's all on the education system, a very convenient issue to say. You know, when people go for solutions like No Child Left Behind, they have to find a convenient group to target. And it right. was, at that time, the classroom teacher. That is the lazy teachers. If we threaten our schools and administrators, we will get them to rise to this occasion. The kids will get better test scores, which is the evidence that they're learning, and all will be well. We will have proven that America really is the world power. It makes no sense to me, but this is the direction that was traveling.
Okay, so we jump forward to 2007. It becomes quite clear that the benchmarks are not going to happen. Now, to a certain extent, I've also heard that, or at that time, that No Child Left Behind was underfunded. Does that make sense? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, even in the discussions in 2001, we had senators like Senator Chris Dodd from Connecticut talking about his concern that No Child Left Behind would be underfunded. All that it means is that more onus is being put on schools and the funding is not there to carry it out.
Okay, so in other words,
Chris Dodd,
you're shooting for the moon. You're shooting for the you're requiring in that law that you shoot for the moon, and the law is saying so essentially it's an unfunded mandate. You need to raise these test scores, and incidentally, we're not going to give you the resources that would actually help you get in that direction.
Right. Now, Chris Dodd raised another point too, and this is something that federal legislation is not going to fix, no matter how punitive, and that is what happens at the state level and how that money filters down to the districts. Because Chris Dodd said, look, Connecticut, we have excellent education system, but you can literally go 15 minutes from one affluent neighborhood to an impoverished neighborhood, and you see it in the schools. And so it's a matter of money filtering down. Now, in the legislation, there are restrictions written to try and get the money to filter down. For example, each of the different programs in this huge omnibus bill that is ESEA restricts the percentage of funding that can go to administrative costs. But it doesn't mean that the remainder of the funding will go where it's needed most. And it can get caught up in politics and just not get where it's needed most. So that's the problem.
Let me just make sure I understand what you're saying. So when federal funds come down the pike, as it were, and get distributed, there is no riders that come with that federal funds that says, okay, you've got 100 schools. 10% of this has to go to each, 1% of this has to go to each of those schools, right? There's nothing of that. They could, on the state level, they can say, well, we're going to put it into a program that may benefit these schools as opposed to those schools, or we're going to put it on how we build up our management system, statewide or something.
Right. Right now, the House reauthorization has this portability of funding written in, which basically turns the whole Title I into a voucher situation. But even that is going to be problematic because to track all that money, you need a much bigger bureaucracy, for one thing. And if I send the money with the kid, then you can see where districts are not going to be able to budget it off, and they're going to be tempted to play games to jockey for certain kids. You know, and so that is just that's the problem too, because it requires more oversight, and I just don't think there is enough oversight. If a kid enrolls at one school, the Title I money goes there. The kid moves, the Title I money is already at one school. Kid goes to another school. Okay, Title I money is not really following the kid, or you could have a situation.
Tell people what Title I money is specifically.
Title I money is the monies for children that are in poverty, a certain percentage of the family income. I think right now it's 200% that the family doesn't make 200%, more than 200% of what's considered poverty income, but it might also, I would have to check.
It more or less tracks
exactly the definition.
But it more or less tracks if you're eligible for the free lunch program. So just so people understand, the way that we fund schools in this country is primarily with property taxes in states. And the property taxes come from the local community. So if you live in a poor community, your property taxes are lower because the value of the real estate there is lower. That's the money that ends up funding the schools. This money is supplemented in poorer districts by Title I money, right? That is earmarked for those places where there's a higher level of poverty. But it's still not enough.
No. And, you know, people say, oh, well, this just proves that money doesn't fix education, and so that money doesn't matter. Well, that's just foolish, you know, because if it didn't matter, then we would have the wealthy people sending their kids to poorer schools. Of course money matters.
Right.
But what doesn't get addressed is that these are systemic problems. Just because I send more money to a poor district, that doesn't mean I've solved all of the district problems of the kids who are entering the schools. And so, yes, it does help. It does help. But it's not going to solve all of the problems associated with the community setting from which these children come to school. Does that make sense? It doesn't.
Yeah, this is the input. I mean,
we've
talked about this on this program many times. The input, in other words, you know, a child coming from a low income family starts off their elementary school career with a deficit, like a listening vocabulary deficit of tens of thousands of words in some instances, sometimes more. And if you are are malnourished, you don't do as well in school. There's the problem is that the inputs in a poorer community are more problematic than the money that's available to address. And I would also argue that in that the amount of money wealthy schools get is undercounted because nobody recognizes, as far as I can see, I haven't seen any data on this, and this is really just anecdotal from my own experience going through public schools in the New York City area. The difference between the Parents Association money can range from literally like $1.2 million for one school down to $15,000 annually. And that, to me, seems to be completely undercounted. So, okay, with all that said, so tell us where we are now with the ESEA, the Elementary Secondary Education Act reauthorization. There's a Senate bill. There's a House bill. These bills basically were both made from scratch. The Senate and the House are meeting in conference to hammer it out. What are give me a list of the two or three things that you are tracking that you see could be the most problematic or most helpful for education on the ground.
From these two bills?
Yes.
Are coming together? Okay. Well, first off, yes, they are going to conference committee, the Senate and the House, and they will craft a single bill out of their two versions. Now, it's the differences in the bill, of course, the major differences are going to be what is of most interest. This portability of funding issue, is the ESEA Title I going to turn into just a big voucher program? The White House, the Obama administration, is against portability of funding. And in the conference discussions, the White House will be included, and the Senate and House are both aware of where the White House stands in that. So I'm thinking that the portability of funding is going to be removed. But, you know, there are no guarantees, and that would be just terrible if Title I money became portable. The Obama administration...
Now, why is that portable? Because why is that portable? Why is
the money.
I'm sorry. So why is that problematic? If the Title I money follows the kid, why is that problematic?
It's just not that easy to track the money,
right,
for one. And it's not easy to budget the money. And so that's going to be an accounting mess. That is my focus.
Okay.
The Obama administration says that some districts that need the money most and have to run schools, you know, those issues don't change because of fewer or more kids. Keeping the lights on, keeping the AC on at a school,
right.
It is a cost that is a fixed cost, so to speak. It doesn't become less if I've got 100 kids or 200 kids or 50 kids. If I've got a building, I've got a building to upkeep. So these are issues. Another is the opt-out provision. The House draft has an omnibus opt-out provision that says, as far as Title I funding, 95% of students, states are supposed to test 95% of their students, and the House reauthorization says, okay, forget states, we're just going to say in this bill parents have the right to opt out, and if they do, then those scores will not be counted against this 95%. The Senate version has language in it that says, it has a rule of construction that says, look, we don't want any state to say that this 95% rule is influencing what the state wants to do about opt-outs. So what that does is it leaves it up to the states to say, okay, how are we going to do opt-outs, which can be very messy.
Okay, let me see if I
have it back together.
Let me see if I understand this. For the high-stakes testing to be valid in terms of being used, and it, as far as I, you know, from my perspective, is used as a bludgeon in some respects. But for that to be used, a certain percentage of students have to participate. But you're saying if in the House bill, if parents opt out, that doesn't count against that 95% number. So there's really no way to defeat. And tell me if I'm wrong, because I'm trying to understand this. There's no way to essentially, like, for instance, in New York schools, I know that there was an attempt this year and to basically disable the high stakes testing. The more people opt out, that you hit a threshold where the testing cannot be used to judge performance of students or teachers.
Well, both bills have removed the language that the tests are mandated to judge teachers. And they have left it to varying degrees. The Senate is more generous. They've left it up to schools to figure out how the school wants to use the data. Now, I have a doctorate in statistics and research. I don't need 95% of any sample to do research. I can randomly select from any sample and do research. So the 95% is more a condition that was put in to make sure the states had to test all students, you see,
mm-hmm.
where the state, that's what that is. We want to make sure you're really giving the tests and the same tests to all students, and so we're telling you, you only have 5% that you can't test, and that might be, for example, severe, profound special education, some English language learners, okay? So it is the federal government that is saying you have to have 95%.
So by not counting
that number.
So by not counting opt-outs against that number, it basically relaxes the standards for the state.
Well, what it acknowledges is it relaxes standards of states, but it also acknowledges the parental role in education.
That's good.
Which has been completely slighted by these bills. They, you know, the Senate bill is more relaxing. It has relaxed more of what the state can do, and the state can even bring in portfolio assessment. It doesn't have to be the traditional standardized test. So there's more relaxing there, but even in the House bill, that can happen. But the bills, the House, in putting that in, has acknowledged the right of a parent to opt his or her children out of the testing. And the Senate draft has said, okay, we're going to leave it up to the states. But basically, the Senate draft says, don't blame us. Don't blame our 95% rule, states, if you don't decide to opt out. And don't say you had to if you do decide. It's your call.
So
that's an issue.
So overall, the idea of we have diminished the high stakes in the high stakes testing.
Yes. And that is a criticism for those. You've got groups like Katie Haycock's Education Trust. Katie Haycock's Education Trust helped craft No Child Left Behind, and she and her group really like that strong federal arm, because she says if you're not tested, you don't count. And so they want that strong federal presence and didn't like that states were gaming the system with No Child Left Behind, because they were setting their annual targets to where they would not be punished for not reaching them, which makes sense to me. You know, why aim for something that is aspirational if you think you're going to have your hand severely slapped if you don't make it?
Right.
You know,
of course,
you make a safe goal. And so we have to remove the sanctions. And on top of that, Sam, we have Arne Duncan wielding those No Child Left Behind waivers. And Arne Duncan has done more to fix in Congress's mind the need to not only relax the state, relax the hold on the state, the federal hold on the state, but also both bills restrict the U.S. Secretary of Education more. And what the U.S. Secretary of Education can require of the states.
So just to be clear, Arne Duncan has not helped his own cause.
No,
and I would argue
not.
To the benefit of schools, in at least in to the benefit of public schools in many respects. So
right.
All right. So you're a high school teacher. Give me a grade of what you predict is going to come out of there. In other words, aren't we already in a better place because we have, it appears, unless, I don't know what could happen, but it appears based upon these two bills that have come out of the House and the Senate, we've gotten rid of a lot of the punitive aspects of this testing regime.
Yes. You know, some people criticize this. They say we're waffling. We're going back to pre-No Child Left Behind, or even No Child Left Behind, where the states could decide. I don't think that ESCA, at the condition it is in now, where the focus is on standardized testing as the outcome for success, I don't think that is ever going to win. I don't think it can. What it will continue to do is it'll force schools to narrow curriculum in order to focus energies on these tests. But, you know, it depends on what the states do with these tests. What the states decide, if the states, a more progressive state, can move to more portfolio assessment and less tests and less testing time.
Right.
You know, but less progressive states can make this reauthorization exactly like No Child Left Behind for their state. They can do that. You know, they can do that. Grading what the Congress is doing, I don't like to give grades on things like this. I think that just reduces the situation.
I understand.
And so I won't give a letter, but I will say that, you know, we need to get away from No Child Left Behind. And I think what the Congress is doing at this moment is good, generally speaking, to get away from it. There are some parts that I think could be very damaging, like this portability of funding issue. And as far as opt-out, what Congress decides with opt-out isn't going to make parents not opt-out. You know, I think parents are getting tired of testing, increasingly so.
And it also seems to me, I mean, I think from my perspective, from what you're saying, from your reporting here, the idea that we've gotten rid of high-stakes testing as a mandate from the federal government, or at least the high-stakes part of it, is a positive. It is a shame, it seems to me, that we can't have the federal government standardize things across the country where it is they're simply saying no high stakes testing rather than allow for states like, let's say, Texas, or maybe Bobby Jindal wants to starve your public schools down there more. And so they implement that a similar regime. That to me seems problematic. But let me give you the last word on that.
OK, well, I think it's time to break the ESCA apart into its different titles. It has 10 titles, okay, 10 different programs. Title I is the biggest, and Title IX is the funding mechanism and administrative, so it doesn't really count. But Title I needs to be broken off, I think, from everything else and be made into block grants. And we really need to, as a country, get away from worshiping standardized tests, because there is no connection between scoring high on standardized tests and America's condition as a world power. Okay?
Yep.
There is just no condition. And those who push for this, who are advocates of this and who are politically positioned, tend to have their kids in schools. Even Arne Duncan had his kids in schools that didn't have Common Core. And he's moving his kids back to Chicago, where they won't be under these standardized testing mandates.
Right.
You know, so those who have the means don't enroll their kids in schools where their teachers are tested using student test scores. It just doesn't happen. We need to, but people are like, well, if we don't use standardized test scores, what will we use? It's like, how's about teacher judgment? You know, how's about valuing the teaching profession? There's been such a knock on the teaching profession. Oh, teachers, they're just lazy. They don't want to teach. Yes, there are some who don't want to, but teaching is difficult. By and large, people don't stay in teaching, public school teaching, because of the money, because
right.
of the career ladder. They do it because they love children. So I will just leave it at that.
Mercedes Schneider, we will put a link to your blog at deutsch29.wordpress.com. The book is The Common Core Dilemma, Who Owns Our Schools? Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. We're going to head into the fun half, take your phone calls. Oh, I'll turn on my IMs right now. 646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, don't forget that it is your membership that makes this show possible. We could not do it without our members supporting everyone. Supporting the entire show. And as a bonus, as a thank you, we say thank you by giving you an extra 50 minutes. I mean, theoretically 50 minutes, but it turns out usually it's more. We got to tighten up the ship a little bit. Ship's getting a little leaky.
Yeah.
Also, you can support this program by buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. It's a win-win-win. Actually, it could be four wins.
It's a win for the earth, too.
We got to set up a task force to find out how many wins there are with this.
Noah?
Blue Ribbon Commission. So many wins at justcoffee.coop. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your crap from there. We get a little kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. Going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with the fun half. Donald Trump. I think this is the first person that he has announced that he would put into his cabinet. And I have to say, again, I'll reiterate, if I were a Republican, I would definitely vote for Donald Trump. The man is a genius.
I think we're creeping into I'm going to vote for Donald Trump territory.
Yes, it's true. This is going to be like those spottings of me around town reading Art of the Deal. We have, at home, we have slowly painting everything gold lame. Big mirrors in the...
Start calling other people at synagogue and the co-op losers.
Yep. That's what's happening.
You
should have seen Saul's face when I called him a loser this morning.
Toughen him up.
Oh, I got him saying, what are you talking? Oh, no, you didn't. We got to put that on.
Perfect. Okay.
All right, we'll be right back.